Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here at PI. It's my first time, and I'm really enjoying my visit very much. I'm looking forward to telling you a bit today about some new ideas we've been playing around with in my group. And I think it is almost always the case that when I start off giving a talk, I start by trying to talk a little bit about biophysics in general and what I think it is, because I think it's good to orient ourselves, especially for some of the questions we're going to try to get into today. So the first question is, you know, a simple one: what is life? And I'm not actually going to try to answer this one for you today, but I want to rather remind you that in some sense you already know the answer to this question. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that we have lots of different ways of talking about the world, and we use lots of different words for it, and the way that we use words is the way that they get their meaning, essentially. So when we say life, I'm going to be very practical and just say we already kind of know rocks are not alive and zebras are alive, and we've sorted things out, roughly speaking, into separate categories, and maybe there's some corner cases at the boundary, but we can start by reasoning about what are the things that are generally true about living things when we decide that they're alive, and also, you know, how do we generally like to reason about them? And when we think like a biologist, when we're starting by being oriented towards this issue of a living thing and understanding its properties, there are certain categories and terms and ways of thinking about this that we tend to gravitate towards. So we think about behavior and function and survival, reproduction, heredity. These are the ways of talking about living things that come most naturally to us when we're trying to understand how they work and what makes them tick and what's interesting about them. And the first point I want to make is that when we think about things from the perspective of physics, we are not necessarily going to talk in the same terms. So we can talk about the same system, the same whale in ocean system, and a priori, our notion of there being anything alive in the system is absent, and we can talk instead about the basic brass tacks sort of components out of which physical reasoning gets built up. So we can talk about distances and times, locations of things. We can talk about numbers of particles that we count. And even things like energy and temperature are really built up out of more basic concepts like these ones above. That physical reasoning a priori is about the positions and momenta of particles, and everything else in some sense can be thought of as being layered on top of that. Now, why is that important? I think the reason that's important is because what it reminds us of is our role as the intuitive interpreter between these two different languages. So I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. So in the grand tradition of physicists endangering cats in their thought experiments, I will propose to you that you could go to the top of a tower and you could throw a cat off the tower. And that wouldn't be very nice, but you know, scientists sometimes do things even more cruel to animals. So let's propose that this thought experiment is something we could do. And if you wanted to, you could ask afterwards, how rapidly is the cat moving when it hits the ground? And the thing I want to point out to you is that if instead we went to the same tower or the same experimenter and the same cat, we could do the same experiment and we could ask a totally different kind of question, which would be, is the cat alive afterwards? And obviously, one of these things is connected to the other, right? How fast the cat is moving when it hits the ground is certainly an interesting piece of data if you're trying to predict whether the cat will survive the ordeal. But I think the thing that's very important to underline here is that no matter how much so that is the case, it will never be the case that asking whether a cat is alive is the same thing as asking how fast it is moving. So that's what I mean by separateness in languages, that there are these different categories, different taxonomies or ways of characterizing the system, and they remain separate, and there's a role always for the scientist to make some kind of intuitive mapping between these two. Now, I don't want to suggest to you that this kind of research is on the cutting edge of biophysics at MIT, but I think moving forward, it at least helps us realize that when we understand biological systems from the perspective of physics, it is valuable for us to start by asking about the physical properties of the system and recognizing that we may be attributing certain properties when we make our analysis of the system that could be shared by other systems that are not alive, and that's okay. And we might still be able to develop a physical theory of how these properties work, and if we do, then we'll be able to say something about the physical properties of living things that will be interesting. So what are some interesting physical properties we can consider? Well, one thing that living things do, and I mean, already, it's not quite a physical property, but it's at least a more general one that we could imagine seeing in systems that aren't alive. Self-replication is a property that we might kind of break off and say, let's study the physics of self-replication. There are other things living things do, like they sense and compute and anticipate things about their environment. So that's a very complex kind of life-like behavior where we can maybe slice that off of the definition of life and just look at it on its own and think about the physics of how processes that do that might work. And also, another thing living things do is they effectively absorb work from their environment. So we're really good at finding food a few times a day so that we stay alive. And generally, living things are in one way or another good at that, right? Plants are good at absorbing solar energy. Bacteria are good at growing on stuff that's edible to them. And if you're going to self-replicate, it of course makes sense that you want to become good at these other two things. We tend to understand how we develop the capacity to be good at these other things in biological systems in terms of natural selection. That if we're going to self-replicate successfully, it's obvious we have to be somewhat effective at these other two features. And so the argument, as it generally goes, going back to Darwin, is that you have lots of different ways you could be, and there are heritable traits that are passed from one generation to the next that determine the way you are to a large extent. And some of those ways are going to help you make copies of yourself more effectively than others. So if your beak is bigger versus smaller, then maybe in a given season it will be easier for you to eat certain kinds of seeds and you'll proliferate. So the Darwinian idea is the better self-replicator takes over the future. And that's our explanation for the adaptations that we see. So that's a very powerful theoretical paradigm for understanding how adaptation emerges, and a very interesting one, and a lot can be said about it. But I think it is important for us to recognize that there are some things that we see in biological organization where there already is something maybe a little bit limiting about this frame. So for example, if I were to compare a blue whale to some algae that grows next to it in the ocean, it's really hard to define in any useful way what the difference in reproductive fitness is between these two things, right? A whale is much bigger than an algae and much more complicated and exhibits many complex adaptations to its environment. The biomass of algae in the ocean is obviously much bigger than the biomass of whales. In either case, it's kind of silly to say one is winning versus the other in any sense. So what that reminds us of is that really defining fitness is easiest to do when we're comparing things that are very similar and we're just seeing as they diverge and go in separate directions in their phase space, so to speak, which one is better at copying itself. But once we are very far down that diverged path and we have different states of organization in the system, we really just don't have a language in the same terms to really explain what is better or worse or more or less successful about one of these other structures. So what I would say rather is, here are two structures that appear in our system that are very well adapted and that persist and flourish there. And it's interesting now to try to figure out, is there a way we can talk about both of them on some common basis that they share so that we can understand what is it that each of them is really good at doing that, and much better at doing perhaps than many of the other things that could have happened in the system instead. And since we're looking for common ground, I think a very exciting common ground to explore is that we think that both of these things are made of matter that obeys the same set of physical laws, or is effectively modeled as doing so in any case. And so if we start with the assumption that maybe this is all stuff that's made of Newton's laws obeying material, then these are different things that can happen in that space, but how do we now explain the things that we see in comparison to the things that we don't see? So that's the overarching view going forward. Is there some kind of general language for defining and understanding adaptation in physical terms? Do we always need Darwinian selection in order to get adaptation? That's a different kind of question. And can we explain the emergence of life-like organization using thermodynamics? So the answers I want to propose to you today for these questions are the following. I think that there is a general language we can reach for, motivated from the standpoint of physics. I think that we don't need Darwinian selection to get adaptation, and that's the interesting claim that, you know, we'll see if you buy by the end. And whether we can explain the emergence of life or not, you know, I'm not going to reach for in this talk, but I think it's certainly tantalizing to gaze in that direction, and we'll have a better sense of what the outlook is for that, at least, once you decide whether you buy what I'm saying by the end of the talk. So, where do we go from here? First of all, here are some hints that should carry us in the right direction in our physical thinking. A few things that are true about all living things. All living things are made of matter. All living things need to eat. All living things give off heat. And all living things cannot grow backwards. This is sort of a motley collection of observations, which I think by the end you should be able to have a better sense of why they're all connected. But the starting point is this last one that's a little peculiar, but many people have observed before, that when you look at living things, there is a pronounced tendency for them to seem to run in one direction. So lots of things run forward and backward equally well. So I can drop a ball and it hits the ground, or I can throw a ball at the on the ground and it will fly up in the air. But you're much more likely to see a plant grow out of a seed and up into a fully flowering or leafy plant than you are to see the reverse moving. And that's an empirical fact and not one that stresses us out too much because we don't think about it very much. And we have a vague notion that, of course, this has something to do with entropy and thermodynamics, that somehow one of these processes is much more likely than the other, and it must be because of the second law of thermodynamics. But the question is, how do we formalize that and take it in new directions? First step is to say, well, being very naive, we might have imagined that things should always be able to run forward and backward and look the same if we don't think about it very carefully. And the reason is because if we have some phase space of coordinates for our system, if we think of some closed system that is initially given some energy and all these coordinates get to run around in their phase space according to Hamilton's equations, so thinking classically, I start here and I wander around and I follow this track, of course, Hamiltonian dynamics are going to lead to an exploration of the surface which will carry us through many different corners of the phase space, and lots of different things can happen. So in principle, anything that has this same energy is allowed to happen. So if we're in a closed system and one time we see the plant growing one way, eventually maybe we should end up back in the other direction where we don't have a plant anymore. And the way we'd formalize this argument from the standpoint of equilibrium thermodynamics, and we're going to eventually run into problems with making this argument, but to start with, we'll remind ourselves of how equilibrium reasoning works, is that whatever observation we want to make about the system, we can coarse grain our phase space and lump it together into different groups of states that have different properties. So there's some R that's a function of my phase space coordinates, and the operative thing here is that different values of R are going to correspond to different numbers of states in this phase space. And so there's one volume that's very big, which is the most common value of R across all the different things, ways of sharing energy around in the system. And so if we now wander around doing this molecularly chaotic trajectory through our phase space, we eventually expect we'll just spend most of our time in this big volume and only rarely visit much smaller volumes. So that's the equilibrium thermodynamics idea. And now, to show you why this is nearly useless for thinking about biological systems, I'll give you another thought experiment. And in fairness, I will now endanger a dog in my thought experiment. So this is sort of the homolog of Schrodinger's cat for thermodynamicists and biologists. It's much simpler than Schrodinger's cat. You take a dog, and you put it in a box, and you close the box, and you wait a trillion years, and open the box and see if the dog is alive or dead. And I don't think many of us have any sense of mystery about the outcome of that experiment, so that's why it's simpler. It's not much of a head-scratcher like Schrodinger's cat. Boltzmann's dog dies. And the reason is because if we think about this closed system and all the different ways that we could classify different states that are available to it on some surface of fixed energy, there are many different things that could happen, and really only a very tiny number of them are going to be ones that we would say, that is a live dog. So if we wander around long enough in this phase space, we're going to spend most of our time in subvolumes that really have nothing to do with being alive and are just going to look like mush or dust or what have you. And what that indicates to us, or what it reminds us of, is of course that living things are always these open systems where the way to understand them is that you have a surrounding reservoir that's maybe at some temperature or some set of chemical potentials, and you have fluxes through the system that are directional, where maybe an external time-varying field does work on the system, and then you exhaust some heat into the surrounding bath. And the biological organization is this structure that exists in this open system in between. And that's how we make thermodynamic sense of seeing these things that would not appear at thermal equilibrium, or seeing things that in the Boltzmann's dog scenario would, if we close the system, eventually just degrade into mush and not look very interesting to us. So now the question is, how do we turn this kind of consideration into something where we can make some formal claim about what happens in biological systems? The other thing we need to remind ourselves of is what I already alluded to, that there's this symmetry in the underlying equations of motion that we're considering that might have led us to expect that we actually should run in both directions equally well. And that is that, you know, I can take a cat and I can drop it and it will fall, or I can drop kick the cat up in the air and give it the same velocity but in a reverse direction and it can fly back upwards. That's the time reversal symmetry of Newtonian equations of motion. There are caveats here for things like magnetic fields, but you know, leaving those considerations aside, we generally are dealing with physical laws where the movie running one way and the movie running the other way both have to be allowed. And if that's the case, that now raises the question, why is it that we don't see plants growing backwards? And of course, the answer is because of this open system thing, that we have to think about not just what's going on in our system, but in the surrounding baths, in the air, all of the gas exchange and heat exchange that's happening when the plant grows in the forward direction. And one way of reminding ourselves of consequences of this is to think about simple ideas from chemical equilibrium, that if I think about a thermal equilibrium setting, a consequence of this time reversal symmetry is that I have this detailed balance that holds, where any pair of reactions, I'm going to have equal and opposite flux at thermal equilibrium and chemical equilibrium, such that my steady state concentrations are going to be, whoops, my steady state concentrations, oh, this always happens. So now I have to drop a cat off the tower again, and we'll get there. Whoa, okay, sorry. I don't usually use these pointers. No. Let's go one forward. My apologies. Your steady state concentrations are going to be related to your rate constants in a simple way. And to put this more specifically, what we mean by that is that at this steady state, there should not be some kind of detailed balance breaking cycle such that you have a steady state set of concentrations, but you tend to run around in a circle more so this way than that way. That would violate our time reversal symmetry. So at thermal equilibrium, in an undriven system, we don't get this detailed balance breaking. It's forbidden by the basic underlying symmetry of the equations of motion. There is already an interesting consequence of this that we can see in the physics here. And that is that when we formalize this a little bit more and we talk about some microstate for our system and some other microstate that it could be in, we can think about in a finite time tau the probability of going to J given that you start in I, or the probability of going to I given that you start in J. And when we compare those stochastic probability matrix elements, what we find is they have to have the ratio of the Boltzmann weights of those two states in thermal equilibrium, because that is a consequence of the detailed balance condition that has to hold at thermal equilibrium. One thing I think, although many of us have seen this equation before in one form or another, one thing I think is not generally that emphasized is that this ratio of Boltzmann weights is also expressible in terms of the heat that is exhausted as you go in the forward direction, because we're not driving the system. So conservation of energy guarantees that going from I to J, you liberate the energy that is the difference between their internal energies, and we call that heat when it goes out into the surrounding thermal bath. And when you put heat into a bath at constant temperature, that is called entropy production. We are producing more entropy in the surrounding thermal bath. And what's interesting is that means that there is a detailed, microscopic, exact relationship between entropy production in the surroundings and what I would call statistical irreversibility. The more so you tend to go from I to J than from J to I, the more so you have to be exhausting more entropy in your surroundings on the way from I to J. That's something that we could have observed a long time ago, and many people did in one way or another, although I still feel like in my own statistical mechanics education, it was not emphasized to me that you can get the constraints on the stochastic propagator for arbitrary non-equilibrium evolution in an undriven system, and that the more irreversible something is, the more entropy you have to produce. That you can get that just from the detailed balance condition of thermal equilibrium. But what's interesting is that you can also derive, and this is something we have more recently from someone named Gavin Crooks and others who did related things in the last 10 to 20 years, that if you have a time-varying field that's acting on your system while it's doing this stochastic evolution in contact with the heat bath, it is still the case that there is an exact microscopically detailed relationship between statistical irreversibility and entropy production. And the only difference is that now, because you have this time-varying field, the amount of heat that you exhaust over each realization of the experiment is in principle different because of the difference in the microstate of the heat bath that you brought in contact with your system. So you have to average over all different possible ways of doing the experiment and average in the appropriate way, where you average exponentially weighting the entropy production. But if you do that, you can show this is just Newtonian matter in contact with the heat bath with an arbitrary time-varying field. It's still the case that statistical irreversibility and entropy production are related. The thing about this, though, is this is a microscopic statement, and we presumably want to understand macro systems. Those are the things we're actually capable of observing, and certainly if we want to understand biological systems, we want to be able to think about many degrees of freedom. We want to be able to think about only certain observables that we can keep track of because we never know exactly what's going on microscopically in the system. So what I want to do now is affect a coarse graining. Sorry, yeah. So in the way that I've written it, I should be more specific. These aren't rates. These are actual probabilities. So if I have a discretized description of my phase space, otherwise they'd be a probability density. But what I'm saying is, in a finite time tau, so I choose a non-zero time tau, what is the probability, conditional probability, given that I start at I in time zero, that in time tau I land in J? There's an additional issue of momentum reversal here and going back, which I'm not going to worry about because let's assume we're dealing with diffusion-dominated systems and time-symmetric drives, but you can complicate that if you want. But yes, absolutely. So this probability depends on everything. This depends on the Hamiltonian of the system. It depends on the exact time-varying field that you're applying. It depends on the temperature that you're at. And so, yeah, it's the full Markov matrix for all possible non-equilibrium dynamics from I, all the different places you can land. Ah, excellent question. So that's a very important point. This is how we generalize away from the usual constraints that we have in dealing with equilibrium statmech. In equilibrium statmech, we say, what it means for my system to be at temperature or inverse temperature beta is that I assume a Boltzmann distribution over microstates for my system. It has equilibrated in contact with the bath. Here, what I'm assuming is that the bath is in contact with my system, and that determines the nature of the stochastic fluctuations, that how I jump from one state to another. But what state I'm in and what probability it has can be a non-equilibrium distribution that evolves over time according to some arbitrary way that's determined by exactly how I'm driving the system. So it's a way of generalizing the idea of a bath. It's sort of like the difference between leaving a table sitting in a room at some temperature for a long time and banging on it with a hammer all the time while it's sitting surrounded by this bath at constant temperature. So one way of formalizing this, and this is actually the way Crookes approached it in the first paper, is if you discretize time, at each moment in time, your applied field has a certain value, and you assume you have a Markov matrix that has as its steady state the thermal equilibrium distribution for that value of the applied field. But then the matrix changes from one time step to the next. You can use that to motivate the argument. The only thing that I would say is that I think there is a microcanonical way of deriving this relation where you don't have to make the assumption of at every moment in time, you have a new Markov matrix as though your heat bath has been born anew. You can make the argument from initializing with a random draw from the heat bath and running the deterministic dynamics, and I think it still holds together, but that's definitely a subtlety. I think when it was first derived, there was this assumption of rapid re-equilibration of the bath at every time step. I don't think you need to make that assumption, but one has to make the argument carefully. All right, so how do we coarse grain and lump these things together? If we're going to start lumping these things together, what we just want to do is say, there are particular observables in the world we're interested in, and we're going to paint different states according to their different values or even their different qualities, right? Because it doesn't have to be a number. So we'll say there's some quality I, or one, Roman numeral one, which is going to be built up out of all these different microstates that have that common quality and otherwise are different from each other. And we have some other quality two, and in a finite time tau under an arbitrary drive in contact with some heat bath, we can still ask about the stochastic dynamics for how it is the case that my observation of the system can evolve from one being the case to two being the case. And implicitly, when I do this, coarse graining, there's going to be some arbitrary starting non-equilibrium distribution over states associated with preparing the system in one. There's some other non-equilibrium distribution over states that's associated with landing in two after time tau under the arbitrary drive. And now we can ask about these coarse-grained probabilities, the probabilities of starting with one observation of the system and after time tau getting a yes answer to your second observation question, and the reverse, the probability of after doing that in an additional time tau and running the field backwards and still in contact with the bath, what's the probability that you now land back where you came from? And what's interesting about this, I think, is that we need to be reminded that we really have a lot of power to decide what these states consist of. So as physicists, we're used to thinking about quantitative observables, but I really like this quotation from Ludwig Wittgenstein, which means the borders of my language are the borders of my world. I get to paint my states however I want. I decide what to call the different phenomena of the world. So starting with a basic microscopic description with just momenta and positions, I can take this collection of microstates and say this corresponds to soup, primordial, or of any other kind that I want. And then I can also take some other collection of microstates and say these correspond to one bacterium sitting in some surrounding broth of nutrients or whatever I might like to call it. I can make these as outlandishly separated as I want. I can choose my time duration as arbitrarily as I want. And at the end of the day, I can still prove a general relation, which is really just layering conservation of probability on top of the microscopic Crookes statement, which allows us to say that now when we quantify irreversibility in this coarse grain sense, where we've done an arbitrary coarse graining, it is still the case that there is a relationship between that irreversibility and what I would call entropy production in the universe, which now includes entropy production in the system and also in the surrounding bath, where you're averaging over all the different possible ways of getting there. And what's interesting about this, or at least one of the things that you can immediately pull out of it, is that using this Jensen inequality property of e to the x versus other functions of a real argument, you can show that given that this is the case, it must be the case that the average total entropy production for this process going from 1 to 2 is bounded from below by a non-zero number. So what we're used to in the second law of thermodynamics is the idea that entropy production in the surroundings has to be positive for a spontaneous process. What this is telling us now is a generalization of the second law, that the more irreversible whatever coarse grain transition we're observing is, the more the total entropy production has to be positive. So what's exciting about that is that it starts to suggest a more informative intuition for comparing different possible processes and saying which are more likely or which are guaranteed to generate more thermodynamic flux in their surroundings based on the observable statistics of different transitions in our system, where we just focus on the qualities or properties of the system that we're interested in. So this has various outgrowths or connections to other research in the past. For example, it's been known since the 60s from Ralph Landauer that if you erase a bit in a computer at constant temperature, thermodynamics guarantees that you have to exhaust a certain amount of heat into your surroundings. So the Landauer bound for bit erasure in irreversible computing turns out to be one special case of this generalization of the second law, where basically this heat production is the heat you're exhausting in your surroundings. This internal entropy term is about changing the Shannon entropy of the information you're storing in your system. And this term with irreversibility essentially has to do with the error tolerance that you allow in your computer, where your bit has to be well stored on a certain time scale that you define in order for your computer to operate effectively. But this has a lot of other outgrowths as well. And one of the things that we've thought about in my group previously is how to understand, for example, self-replication. So I'm well aware that whales don't reproduce asexually, at least near the surface of the ocean where we can see them. But still in this picture, we can imagine, you know, I have some biological organism, and I could specify in a simple stochastic model now the internal entropy change associated with the production of another copy in the system, a growth rate at which it tends to happen somewhat stochastically, perhaps an average dissipation in the surroundings. This is the entropy production in the surroundings. And also some rate of reversal, which is ridiculously small in the case of whales and for many other processes as well. But in formal terms, when we think about thermal fluctuations, we have to acknowledge the probability is non-zero of something running in the reverse direction. And that's important because what it means for us is that we can make a statement about the relationship between thermodynamic flux and things that we might actually be interested in thinking about with self-replicators like growth. So once I define all these quantities, I can imagine holding certain ones fixed. So for example, whatever the tiny problem of a whale running backwards is, perhaps that is reasonably modeled as some property mainly of the materials out of which it's built, that once they're stuck together, thermal fluctuations takes a certain amount of time to shake them apart. So if I assume that's fixed, and also the internal organization of the system is fixed, and I just consider the trade-off between growth rate and dissipation in the surrounding reservoir, one interesting consequence of this is that the maximum rate at which I can grow ends up being pegged to how much entropy production I'm doing in my surroundings. So we already have the intuition that if I'm going to grow fast, I need to eat more. But now we actually have physics arguing for that in fairly general considerations, that if I'm going to grow faster and keep everything else fixed, the only way I can do that is to exhaust more into my surroundings. And by conservation of energy, I have to absorb more sources of work in order to dissipate more in my surroundings. So we have already a way of trying to develop thermodynamic constraints for processes of self-replication, and you can go in interesting directions with this. But the place I want to draw your eye now is towards an outlook that I'm going to tell you about, which we've been exploring in my group more recently, which I am at least as excited about, and that is that it so happens when we make this argument that if you're better at growing faster, it seems like being a better dissipator in your surroundings is a consequence of that, if we're holding the right parameters here fixed. That all things being equal, being a Darwinian winner is also somehow about having dissipated more in your surroundings when you get to the finish line, so to speak, when you've replicated a lot. Now, that could be a coincidence, but it's a very suggestive one, because it's giving us a way of saying now that there's some kind of linkage between the thermodynamic flux in our surroundings and how represented we expect to see certain structures be when we propagate things forward in evolution and look at the likely future outcomes. So walking things back a little bit, it turns out that we can formalize this idea and make it a lot more rigorous by considering this scenario. So before we were thinking about one to two or one state and going back and forth between one state and another, but now I want to consider a starting state of arbitrary construction, and I want to now compare the likelihood of ending up in this ending state after finite time and an arbitrary drive versus this one. So how do I compare two different possible outcomes, two different ways of arranging the same matter? What's interesting about this is that you can take the expression that we saw previously, which led us to this generalization of the second law, and we can keep it in its equality form instead of making an inequality, and break it apart heuristically in this way, where it starts to be quite informative. That when I compare the relative likelihood of B versus C, I get to have a few different terms that separately contribute in this all things being equal comparison to determining relative likelihood of outcomes. Is there a question there? Or maybe, oh, okay. No, that's a great question. So when we are now trying to zoom out and talk about all possible non-equilibrium processes, what's tricky here is that some non-equilibrium processes don't seem to lead somewhere interesting in the sense that fire is very much out of equilibrium, but what it leads to is ashes. And ashes don't seem to us to be organized in an interesting way. So does that mean that we're sort of sweeping something under the rug here? I don't think that's the case. But what I'm trying to do here with this equation in particular is make a big tent where we can fit fire, hurricanes, snowflakes, living things. And there is one thermodynamic framework in which we can describe all of them. But exactly what we expect to see at the end in each case is going to be different depending on finer details of initial conditions, the Hamiltonian, the drive, those kinds of things. So if you'll bear with me, I think we can try to make sense of that a little bit later on once we pick this apart. But first of all, the question is, you know, what does this equation correspond to? And although it may not be immediately obvious, what I'll tell you is that this is the generalization of Gibbs or Helmholtz free energy for an arbitrarily driven non-equilibrium process evolving over finite time. So why is that? Well, I'm taking the log of relative likelihood. Whoops. Oh, doing that again. All right. I'm taking the log of relative likelihood here for two different outcomes. And that would have previously been some kind of free energy difference between those two ensembles. And interestingly, on the other side of equation, in the limit where I'm not driving the system and I wait an infinite amount of time, this thing reduces to Helmholtz free energy because this is my internal entropy difference. I'm looking for E minus TS, right? So this is my internal entropy difference, my S. And my dissipation in the reservoir, if all I'm doing is going from one state of a certain energy to another, is going to be my change in energy. So this term is going to be your E, and this is your S in E minus TS. But now that we're far from equilibrium, we have more terms, and we have to be more careful about some of the interpretations. So the first term is, like we said before, the one that's easiest. It is easier to hit a bigger target in phase space than a smaller one. So if we have some Shannon entropy difference defined between these two distributions, there's still some sense in which one of them is more disordered than the other. All things being equal in contact with a bath, it is easier to go to the place that is more disordered. However, we also have a new term that is not at all from our equilibrium intuition, which is a kinetic term that's basically saying this. It's easier to go from A to B in finite time if it's easier to come back from B to A in the same amount of time. A way of getting an intuition for this is just by saying if you lower an activation barrier, the exchange between states gets faster in both directions. So this is a genuinely non-equilibrium contribution that we don't see at equilibrium that we have to take into account. Wherever I start after finite time, there are certain things it's easy to get to from there, and there are other things it's very hard to get to from there because it requires a lot of rearrangement. And all things being equal, I tend to go where I'm proximal to. But now we get to the last term, and this is where things get, I think, quite intriguing. We have to think about the meaning of this minus log of average of exponential of something. So as I said before, when we're not driving the system and we wait an infinite amount of time, we get a simplification here where this is just telling us about the heat that comes from our change in internal energy. But when we are driving the system, the heat that comes out is a more complicated function of the arrangement of the system. Because not all arrangements of the system dissipate the same amount of heat in their surroundings under a given drive. But what we can do is think about now the statistics of this whole distribution of possible entropy productions in the surroundings as we're driving the system. And this is, as it turns out, a cumulative generating function. So what that means is that we can heuristically break it apart into two pieces, the average of the distribution and the fluctuations. And what's interesting is that these things pull in opposite directions. That all things being equal, I have a pressure from this term to do two things. On the one hand, I'm trying to increase the positive average value of my entropy production. I'm trying to do more entropy production in the surroundings. And the more so I do that, the more likely I am to go somewhere. When I look back at this equation. So partly what I'm trying to do is increase average dissipation. But the other part is I'm trying to reduce the fluctuation about the average. I have this pressure to suppress that fluctuation and make it so that all the ways of getting from A to B reliably dissipate a lot, as opposed to sometimes where you could have very high average dissipation, but also a very dispersed fluctuation. And as a result, that kills you, and you end up not having the outcome be so likely, even though the average dissipation is high. So it gets a little subtle. But we can formalize, rather, I shouldn't say formalize, we can take this formal claim, and we can generate a better intuition for it by thinking about transition state theory and Arrhenius behavior in rates. So this is just a simple thing from chemistry, where we have the idea of two different states that are separated by some activation barrier, and as we change the barrier height, we change the rate for crossing the barrier in a way that is controlled by the temperature. So what happens now if we look at a system like this? What I want to do is do an all things being equal comparison where I fix everything else. I'm looking at microstates, so I'm not going to worry about internal entropy, and I'm going to fix the return probability to my starting state so that I can just think about this relationship between reliable dissipation and drift. And what I find here is that as I oscillate the energies of these states, I can contrive a situation where I drive the system so that this state goes up and down like this, this transition state accordingly like so, and this is what happens when we drive a system. We change the energies of the different states in different ways. And what's interesting is that in this scenario, as this state energy goes up, this transition state goes down. But as this transition state goes down, this state also goes down. And what that means is that when we look at the return probability from this state, it is always governed by a barrier of high delta E, as over here. So coming back from there has the same rate as coming back from there. But now when we think about going in the forward direction, I think this thing may be on its last legs. Okay, so I've used up the juice in this thing. All right, as we think about going in the forward direction, the story is different. Why? Because as I oscillate the energies, I can cross the barrier very rapidly in the leftward direction because of the tandem way that these states are oscillating their energies. And as I do so, I drop down and I dissipate heat. But now when I'm trying to go back in the reverse direction, I don't get any help from the drive in coming back. So there's this inseparable relationship between reliable dissipation in one direction and your inability to return by the way you came with any additional help from the drive. So there are going to be just some ways of going through phase space where the drive is going to help you go more in one direction than the other, and where you get that drift is exactly where you get reliable dissipation. What does that mean for our understanding of the consequences of evolutionary outcomes in these driven stochastic systems? Well, one thing that we haven't thought about much yet is what it takes in order to get the system to do a lot of work on you so that you can dissipate a lot. Describing things in these terms, I've already set it out for you. I've told you these states go up and down in energy, and you have no idea what the identity of these states are or what microscopic degrees of freedom give them their properties. But in reality, we're always going to write down some Hamiltonian for our system and say, these are the equations of motion it obeys, and this is why it moves this way when I push on it that way, or such and such. And a simple intuition I want to put in your mind is that of resonance. Usually, when I think about a driven harmonic oscillator, the way I think about it is it has some fixed natural frequency, and I can change the frequency of the drive that I apply. And if I get on resonance, then the system moves around a lot. But you can also think about flipping it around and tuning the K or the M in the system, tuning the natural frequency while keeping the drive fixed. So you can think of the drive as like a time-varying environment with some fixed property. And now I can choose what kind of oscillator I want to be. And if I decide to be an oscillator that happens to resonate a lot with the drive, what happens? More resonance means more motion in the same time-varying environment. And since work is integral of FdX, more motion means more work, potentially. And if you do more work by conservation of energy, you can dissipate more in your surroundings. So there's this hint of a suggestion here that resonance is something we should be thinking about as a way for our system to arrange itself in such a way that it absorbs an especially large amount of work from a time-varying environment that has some fixed frequency in it. Why is that an interesting example? I think the argument is going to be that if we start with a system in an arbitrary arrangement and we're giving it some time-varying field of a fixed frequency, there are different kinds of states that it could then go to, right? It could become organized in different ways subsequently. And it's going to do that by stochastically fluctuating through states, starting off in some particular arrangement. The thermal fluctuations help it jump around. The drive also pushes on it one way, then the other. And what we're interested in thinking about is the story of how you get from A to C versus the story of how you get from A to B. And what may distinguish B and C now is the states we pass through on the way there and how much they're absorbing work from the particular driving frequency. And the exciting thing about having a system with lots of degrees of freedom, as we know, is that it has lots of different normal modes, which are the local oscillatory behaviors that are particular to some arrangement of the system. So of all the different shapes you can be in, you have the option of having different mechanical response properties that are going to see this driving frequency very differently. So I think the intuition that comes from skiing is that if you're wandering around in a rugged landscape and you cross-country ski and wherever you find a ski lift, you tend to go up the hill and then you ski down the other side. If you wander around for long enough and the ski lifts are randomly laid down, you're going to end up wandering into the part of the mountain range where the ski lifts tend to go in more than they tend to go out. And those are exactly the parts of the phase space that have this special extra coupling to the drive, where there are lots of ways that the system has found to resonate with the external fields, and as a result are getting pushed into that region of phase space by coupling to the drive in ways that are particular to their local mechanical response properties. So in the same way that in this mountain range you end up in this special place where the random distribution of ski lifts just happens to be pointing you in that direction, the idea is that in a system with a large combinatorial space of possibilities, there may be particular arrangements where there's a path of mechanical response properties where this drive is going to help you get there by helping you find states that resonate a lot and carrying you forward. So I guess that's the intuition that I was just trying to talk through. I should have put that slide up already. And now, before showing you some empirical results that are suggestive in this direction, so I admit fully that I just did a bunch of jumping up and down and waving my hands. And I think the reason is that I actually find it much more challenging to formalize in a particular analytical model the things that I've just said than I do making a simulation and looking to see whether the empirical result holds. So what we have in the same way of E minus TS is some general intuition for what should happen in these driven systems. And now the question is whether we can see the phenomenon that we're looking for in the qualitative way. So just the same way as I see in biological systems, a notable ability to be much better at absorbing work energy than from their surrounding drives than a random rearrangement of the same matter, right? A plant is better at absorbing work energy in a reliable way from its surrounding drives than if we put the plant in a molecular blender and randomize the arrangement of its atoms. I should also now be thinking about whether there are systems in the world I can either test in experiments or simulate that might exhibit the same property sheerly because they have Newtonian dynamics or time-reversible dynamics as their underlying propagator. So one example that a student of mine found in the literature that we find quite intriguing is there's some evidence that when you see silver nanorods self-assembling, you can actually tune the way that they assemble with the light that you shine on them while they do it. So they're fluctuating around and clumping together. And in this experimental paper, at least, it was found that the surface plasmon resonance of these nanorods was matched to the frequency of the light that was being shined on the nanorods while they were assembling. So you do have this possibility of an emergent resonance. But whether you see that in the general case, in fire or something like that, you have to be careful about what specific system you're talking about. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to formalize this idea in a simulation framework where we could see evolution in a toy chemistry and look for this emergent behavior that we've been trying to predict from general thermodynamic considerations. So what we made up was a very simple collection of Brownian particles living in a fluctuating bath, where what they do basically is diffuse around and experience a viscous drag. But there's also a simple chemical rule that obeys an Arrhenius law, where when particles are close to each other, you can have a harmonic bond form or break between them. So it's a fully stochastic model with well-defined physics behind all of the interactions that happen. And now the question is, what happens in the system when you take one of the particles and apply an oscillatory drive? So now you create the possibility that there's the absorption of work from the applied driving field. And you let this network of oscillators evolve. So the bonds form and break, and the topology of the network can change over time. So when we did this in simulation, what we found when we looked at the normal mode spectrum of an ensemble of stochastic realizations of this was quite striking. In each one of these plots, we've been driving the same system at a different frequency, and the vertical line is the frequency that we're driving at. And then we're just looking at the density of normal modes in this oscillator network. You can see that we chose the rules to be oscillator networks so that we could immediately get the normal modes very cheaply in computational terms. And what we find is that we can move around this extra peak in the normal mode spectrum, which is not really apparent in the individual stochastic realization, but is apparent in the statistical ensemble of structures that you find in multiple realizations. You can move it around just by tuning the frequency that you're driving the system at. And I think it's really important to emphasize here, this is not phase locking or some kind of synchronization phenomenon. We're not saying that the system is moving in sync with the drive. This is a driven oscillator network, which means it's required by its equations of motion in between bond events to move in sync with the drive anyway. What we're seeing here is a rewiring of these bonds so that more of the normal modes of the system respond more to the drive. And you can see this even if you drive way away from the gap in the frequency spectrum that is allowed at a given bond number. So there's a regime where if you make a random network, this equilibrium network, where we have, I think it's half filling of bonds, where there's a frequency gap between zero and the minimum allowed frequency that you basically see in the system. And you can drive in that gap with this blue vertical line. And what you see over time is that this ensemble of normal modes just evolves towards the drive, and you get more response from the modes. So we have the average response of each of the modes in the bottom. And what you can see is that the network is reorganizing so that more and more of its normal modes are jumping around more and more. And of course, as they do, more work is getting done in them, and more dissipation is happening. Now, what exactly is happening as this goes on? We're still trying to figure that out. I mean, it's very exciting, but when you look at these networks and watch them evolve, it's very hard to tell exactly what's changing in the topology of the network. This is spontaneous reorganization of a network where we can predict the mechanical response property while having no idea how it rewires in order to achieve that. The one thing that I would say I notice in this movie, if you run it over again, is that if you look on the left, you have the non-equilibrium simulation, and the orange particle is the one that's being driven. The number of bonds is what's being colored in edges per node in this graph. And so while the driven particle maintains a lot of bonds, the other bonds in the network, maybe you're starting to lose bonds. So something is happening where the driven particle is becoming special in this network, whereas on the right-hand side, that's an equilibrium simulation where one particle is singled out because they started from the same microstate, but it just randomly redistributes bonds around the whole system, and nothing interesting happens in the topology. But other than that, I think it's still quite open what is going on, and we're still quite interested to try to make sense of the anatomy of this emergent structure. How does it achieve this extra number of normal modes that it is learning to have over time that helps it absorb more work energy from its environment? Lastly, I'll just say that this is very preliminary, and I'm still not sure I trust this figure in terms of demonstrating what I wanted to. We have to look and see whether we can demonstrate, as we predicted, that entropy production is the explanation for the emergent organization. So can we track entropy production in the system over time and find that it correlates with this shift towards extra resonance? And what we find is that over time, as you go back and forth, so we start with this arrangement of the system. We start with this arrangement of the system, and you have individual microtrajectories in their normal mode spectra, and you track the entropy production up top. And then as you move it forward, you have two microtrajectories that do more entropy production, one that does less, and the ones that do more are the ones that are drifting down towards the driving frequency. So that's maybe a suggestion that the mechanism we're proposing thermodynamically is the one that we're seeing, although I think looking at this in individual realizations, it's too easy to find anecdotes. So I'm trying to find a better way of showing this. The other thing I'll just briefly mention is that that entropy production is actually just the entropy production associated with bonds forming and breaking. So it doesn't have to do with the steady state dissipation of the driven oscillator. The reason that's important is because in between bonding events, you reach this new driven steady state, and a lot of the entropy production you do has nothing to do with helping you get anywhere, because you're just running around in circles and doing a futile cycle. So this entropy production is a subportion of the entropy production you do, and it's the part that we would consider to be important for the kind of evolutionary outcome that we're thinking about. So What can we take away from this? First of all, time reversibility of Newton's laws guarantees a relationship between irreversibility and entropy production, and structures that form through reliable entropy production in a time-varying environment have the opportunity to seem adapted to eating from their surroundings. Now, back to this issue of fire, I think a really important thing for us to emphasize here is that we don't necessarily expect to see this kind of organization emerging in all systems that underwent some kind of non-equilibrium evolution. Because if we're very careful, what we have to say is the story is about the extra entropy production you do on the way to the state that you land in. So sometimes you can get a non-equilibrium outcome that's like ashes or like diamond, where a lot of entropy production happens on the way there, and then it gets you into this kinetic trap, and maybe the kinetic trap doesn't have any interesting dynamical properties. But sometimes the entropy production not only helps you get where you're going, but it helps you stay there and prevents you from leaving. And it keeps you in this dynamical process that has a hard time leaving that corner of phase space. And I think those are the ones we're really interested in going after for looking at some kind of analog to biological organization. And whether you see that or not in a given system, I think, is going to depend a lot on the Hamiltonian and the details. So it goes to an additional level of subtlety that I would love to discuss with any of you who are interested, but we don't have time for right now. But I will definitely just say that it's not appropriate to say that everything is just evolving in lifelike ways all the time. The details of the physical conditions and the working material and the drive do matter. But I think it may be that we have the opportunity to see lifelike organization in a much broader class of driven systems than we've necessarily appreciated before. And something I'm particularly excited about in this sense is that not only does this give us an opportunity, perhaps, to see Darwinian selection as a special case of a more general physical phenomenon, because if dissipation comes from self-replication, then of course dissipating reliably more is very much the same thing as being Darwinianly fit. But you don't have to have a self-replicator in your system in order to become an adapted structure. It's also interesting to consider what happens when we are living in a fluctuating environment, where we're not just driving at some frequency, but we have a past with some correlated fluctuations that may give us some information about what's likely to happen in the future. Because what that then suggests is that there may be thermodynamic drives towards organized states that are somehow good at anticipating changes that are about to happen in their environment, so that they're already running in the right direction when the force starts pushing that way. And I find that to be a highly exciting direction that we want to explore in my group, because it suggests the possibility that we could see emergent computation or emergent anticipation in systems that don't even have brains or parents or any process of Darwinian selection even happening in them. So all of that is very much for the future. And for now, for the present, what I would like to do is thank very much the students either in or visiting my group who contributed to this work by doing excellent studies of both the theoretical and computational nature, and also to Thomas and Virginia Cabot, who endowed my professorship at MIT, and you very much for your attention. Thanks a lot.
So, questions?
I wondered what you meant by your phrase, as I recall it, you said, no need to discuss self-replication in a slide about two-thirds of the way through. Is that might mean that you have it under control or that it's not there?
So I may not have meant to say no need to discuss it. I guess what I may have meant is that, so in an earlier version of this talk, or in the parent of this talk, if the way you think about it, there was a lot more focus on self-replicators. And I think that on its own is an interesting subject, right? That there are arguments you can make for constraints that thermodynamics provides in how self-replicators can work, given that they're made of certain materials. So you might imagine that, in principle, you have enough flexibility to specify how rapidly something grows, how rapidly it falls apart, how internally organized it is, and also how much heat it has to exhaust into its surroundings at whatever temperature it grows at, But then you find is if it's made of Newtonian matter, it has to obey certain constraints that relate those quantities. I think the reason I step away from self-replication in this discussion is because what I want to emphasize is I got drawn into this subject because I was interested in understanding self-replicators, and now what I'm finding to be very interesting to consider alternatively is that many of the lifelike properties that we assume have to come from selective pressure after a Darwinian process of self-replication and competition begins may actually be something that you can get from the thermodynamics even before any apparent self-replication process starts in your system. So the non-equilibrium evolution of your driven system could find a state that looks very adapted to time-varying external drives in terms of its ability to absorb work energy, or perhaps its ability even to behave in ways that seem to anticipate changes in the environment without having ever had parents or had processes of self-replication going on. So I guess I just want to maybe knock self-replication off its pedestal a little bit and say, let's look for these phenomena wherever we can find them. And the physics is suggesting it may be easier for us to find them in places where you know we don't have to build a self-replicating system in simulation before we can look for them. All right, so the question now, I guess, if I can take it in the sense that it's referring to, it's asking about this experimental result, but I think that's maybe being used as a metaphor. Whoa, I just ran back way too many slides. Sorry, it always happens, doesn't it? So the silver rods was the specific case where you saw this resonance phenomenon that emerges in one experimental setting, and now the question is, how long do you have to wait for this to happen? So,
the question is, how much do you have to think before making it happen?
Right, okay. So, that's a good question because what it points to is how much does our choice of the working material, the temperature that we're at, and the drive matter in determining whether we can expect to see an adaptation phenomenon like this happening? And I think that there are a lot of factors here. So one of them, for example, is that if you live at very high temperature and all the barriers you might cross, you can cross very rapidly from thermal fluctuations on timescales where your drive is not changing very much. You're essentially always near equilibrium. And to get far from equilibrium, what you need is to be getting constantly stuck in these kinetic traps where your driving field is the only thing that can help you get into them or out of them. So that already immediately determines some things about the relationship between the Hamiltonian of your working material, your driving field, and your temperature. In addition, I think you definitely need to have a large combinatorial space of possible arrangements of your system in order to make this argument stick that you should be somehow finding particular arrangements of them that have very special properties, because the only thing that opens up the possibility of, if I can find this other equation here, the only thing that opens up the possibility in interpreting this equation for the dynamics, where we can argue from this last term that we should see ordered durable states where they have this story of a lot of dissipation happening on the way there, that is always constrained by what's actually accessible on the time horizon that we're looking at. So if it's the case that nothing is kinetically accessible except very uninteresting looking structures on the timescale that we're simulating or experimenting, and that's a contingent property of the particular Hamiltonian we're using, then this remains true but is not going to tell us anything about interesting self-organization that can happen in the system. But on timescales where we can start to explore a really vast phase space, we can start to make the argument that on some surface of fixed kinetic accessibility, that contains likely trajectories for the system, I can now say that whatever I see is going to look like it was optimized for that last term over a very diverse set of outcomes. And that's where we start to be able to perhaps make the argument for this being a general phenomenon. My intuition is it becomes a general phenomenon where you have a vast combinatorial space of possibilities and you're always getting lost, and in every experiment you never visit remotely the same corner of phase space over again. So That being said, taking that beyond an intuition and making it rigorous, part of what's tricky about that is that ultimately I think we're the ones who are the arbiters of how interesting the phenomenon that we see is. And so whether we think the organization that emerges is striking is something we almost have to guess out of our judgment about what this Hamiltonian can lead to if we give it enough time. So all I'm trying to do is kind of work from things that vaguely resemble what I know can generate interesting results. I'm made of chemicals, and so if that's the case, I should try to make a model of something that kind of behaves like chemistry, and then maybe you can do something interesting.
When you talked about self-replicating whales, you derived an estimate for the amount of heat dissipated in the medium given growth rates and the opposite of growth rates. Mm-hmm. So is there any empirical evidence for this estimate being realized in nature?
So the tricky thing with this, I mean, so in the paper that I wrote about this subject, I was trying to do something very heuristic, which I think you can always poke holes in, which is to say, when we go to this equation here, and we say we've set a bound on the total entropy production that's determined by these coarse-grained probabilities that really are related in some sense to the timescales on which we expect to see these events happen probabilistically. If we're talking about one as being one bacterium and two as being two bacteria, then the probability of that happening in 20 minutes is order unity. It may not be one, but it's roughly that order. And on log scale, that's what we care about. The probability of going from two bacteria to one is essentially zero. And estimating something that is close to zero by making heuristic arguments is something it's very easy to disagree with. What I was trying to do is say in the paper that there is a lower bound set here, and if I can set a lower bound on the lower bound, then it's still a lower bound. So if I can estimate a probability that is larger than the real probability that I'm looking at here, then maybe I am in good shape. And so the probability that was considered in the paper was the spontaneous breaking of all the peptide bonds that formed all the proteins in the cell, because we can experimentally measure the spontaneous rate of breaking of a single peptide bond under physiological conditions. And when you make that estimate, you can at least find that the bound that it allows you to set is satisfied by the actual amount of heat that a bacterium generates. But of course, the bacterium generates much, much more heat than the bound. So on the one hand, you can say, okay, good, this thing is obeying what seemed to me to be the physical laws that I think it should be trying to obey. And yet at the same time, if it's so far away from the point of disobedience, then the question is, what is the bound really setting as a constraint for how this thing operates? And what's tricky is that bacterial cells are not just trying to grow as fast as possible. They're trying to operate sensing mechanisms that can change the state of the system. They're doing all of these futile cycles that keep the bacterium in this prime state where it's ready to adapt its behavior to changes in its environment. So a lot of the heat that it generates doesn't even necessarily have to do with copying itself. So I think that when thinking about real thermodynamic constraints, what you probably need to do is split things into pieces a little bit more. You need to think about smaller portions of the process. So you could think about an out-of-equilibrium process in the cell that involves a fewer number of degrees of freedom, and maybe you can start to get something interesting. So where we're trying to do things like that in my group is thinking about proteins in the cell collecting together at one point, whereas they were spread out over the cell beforehand, and whether you can estimate the amount of ATP that the cell had to spend on that, given the statistical irreversibility of the process, which is stochastic enough that maybe you can actually measure the forward and reverse rates. So I think that setting real bounds that are you can take into experiment, you probably do need to start looking at more micro or nanomechanical systems. But what I find funny enough is that despite that, you can get almost a kind of qualitative prediction about the general properties of these very long timescale evolutionary scenarios by just doing the same kind of thing we do with the trade-off of energy and entropy at equilibrium, where we look at these different terms and we try to reason about the pressures that each of them is producing on the system. But I think it's much easier to reason that way qualitatively than to say, this is the number that I now take over to the self-replicator or the evolutionary process.
So it seems to me that there is a backdoor through which replication can creep in even without demanding natural selection. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to be sustainably good at anything, for instance in dissipation, but in anything, then it's a good idea to be a replicator, because machines deteriorate, and it's a good idea to keep building new ones from scratch. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, so that's a nice point. So the question is, I might rephrase it a little bit and say that could it be the case that in any driven non-equilibrium system, I could post hoc argue that there is some spreading quality of organization or some thing in some way of explaining why it goes where it goes, where I could claim that there is a self-reproducing pattern that takes over in the system. And that gets back to this issue of fire, right? So fire is kind of on the borderline a little bit. It is, in a sense, a self-replicating phenomenon, but we don't usually think of it as a self because it's more this process that just spreads through a whole medium. And I think there is some truth to that, in that if we keep track of the right degrees of freedom in the system, I'm sure that you could write down a mathematical model of what's happening in a driven system where you claim that there is something in the system that is growing exponentially, and any process of exponential growth is irreversible and looks like something copying itself in a sense. So that may be so, but what I would say is that we don't need to know what the self-replicating self is in the system in order for us to try to make predictions about some of the thermodynamics of its long-term properties, first of all. And second of all, that I think when people look at self-replicating biological systems, they really have a higher bar for what they mean by that, that they're not looking at something like fire, but they're saying, this is a really complex, reproducibly organized whole that has a boundary around it and that wanders around in space. And it might be the case that there is a broad domain of physical conditions where you expect to see structures like that emerge, but it could also be the case where different conditions don't give you that because everything is too connected or strongly coupled or interacting with everything else. So in this system that we're simulating here with the harmonic bonds, what I would say about it is that already in terms of the equilibrium behavior for this system, if you just change the specific volume of your collection of particles and the bond energy, the temperature, those things all together will map out an equilibrium phase diagram with different regimes, one where everything percolates, one where you have particles and clusters that tend to wander around. And if you start driving it in those different regimes, you could imagine in one case you see clusters that use the drive to reproduce themselves, and another regime where you just have this kind of hive or web that vibrates around and changes itself as a whole. So I think it gets back to this eye of beholder thing with I define the self in the system that I'm looking for. If it's valuable to me in making sense of a system to identify a self and track its population dynamics, that could be a thing that I would want to do. But it's also conceivable that finding that self that is relevant to the interesting behavior in the system I'm looking at is very difficult, but I can nevertheless make predictions about the behavior. And even in biological systems, we sort of see that, because I could, you know, map out a spectrum between a whole multicellular organism and a completely separate population of cells, and in between you have interacting, co-evolving populations of cells, or systems like Dictyostelium, where they can be either separate or they can collect together into one whole that coordinates their behavior to a larger degree. So you have a lot of different modes of correlated action that's more like a hive or separate cells that go on their own, even just in the biological world. And the nice thing, I think, with starting from Newtonian physics is that maybe to some degree you don't have to figure all of that out first before making some predictions about the long time horizon physical properties that you should expect to see regardless of how the system achieves that.
Any other questions?
Yeah. I mean, self-replication is something that could happen at a much larger time scale. So you are focusing on something at a shorter time scale in which there is this kind of resonance.
Mm-hmm.
Because in real biology, self-replication is very complicated. there is genetics and
Right. So that's a good point that you can think about different time horizons here. Like if you're trying to think about origins of life type scenarios, I think one thing that's interesting to consider is at some point you get a self-replicator, presumably. And afterwards, the Darwinian mechanism is a very important part of the explanation of what you with high likelihood see afterwards. But I think that our notion of the origins of life, when we think about it in a rudimentary way, has been that there's something that kind of looks like an equilibrium collection of stuff, and at some point a freak occurrence produces a self-replicator, and then you're off to the races. And what you've hit on the head here is that what we now can make an argument for is a constant non-equilibrium evolution towards states that look less and less like the Boltzmann distribution as they accumulate more and more information about the environment, such that when the first self-replicator bursts onto the scene, the toolbox that it has to draw on of all these self-organized structures that could be there could actually be quite rich. So when we see organization in nature that seems in some sense to have function, we don't necessarily have to find that explanation in the incremental modification of something that a parent was doing. It could be that the first version of that actually just got kind of popped in as a module from something that was floating around. And we already kind of see examples of that, right? And we know that when you look at water as it falls down mountains and branches out, it looks rather a lot like vein structures in plants or in mammals. And it's clear that making branch structures is not actually so hard, but it is an out of equilibrium process. And it is an out of equilibrium structure that already is specialized enough at something that it can be co-opted and used for various functions once biological systems with self-replication in them take advantage.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.